Hey, everybody. The Other People podcast is entirely free. It is offered freely. Nearly 600 episodes, all available free of charge. This is a listener-supported show. If you like the podcast and you would like to support it, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
Hello.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Hello.
Just one person and just one.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I am in Los Angeles. It's nice to be with you. It is nice to have Sarah McCall on the program today. She has a memoir out right now on Live Right Press. It is called Joy Enough. Joy Enough. She was great. She came over not too long ago, and she was ready to talk. She was ready to communicate. We had it out right here in this garage, and I recorded it. And by had it out, I don't mean to say that we were arguing or that it was contentious in any way. It was great. It was delightful. It was friendly. And we talked about stuff. We got into it. You're going to hear this in just a moment. She was a great guest. So I also want to add that her book is wonderful. It's a grief memoir. Or a griefy memoir, if I may use the word griefy. Not an easy thing to write about, and she manages to pull it off. Joy Enough, once again, is the title. Sarah McCall, the author, and my guest today on the program. So I'm watching my dog right now. She's supposed to be, like, I'm trying to, like, integrate her into this so that we can be companions, so that she can feel like she's included in as many activities as possible. But she makes a noise. She can't resist making noise when I'm trying to record. While I have... And my dog is named Twiggy. My daughter named her. And it actually suits her perfectly. She's very skinny. But... And she's got, like, long... She's kind of like a whippet, you know? It sort of looks like that. She's really just a mongrel dog. She's kind of a little bit of everything. But the other day... Like, I'm training Twiggy. I'm trying to make sure that she's a well-behaved animal. And so... In the mornings lately, or at least some mornings, I will walk her around the neighborhood and go to a coffee shop, and I will, like, put her on a sit-stay. I'll say, sit, stay, and I will go inside the coffee shop to get my beverage, and we're kind of practicing. Like, she's learning how to handle herself when I'm inside of a retail establishment. And she's good at it. She's doing well. This is a smart dog. She's responding well to... training. But this week, you know, if you can picture it, it's about like 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning. It's early. Sun is just coming up. I've got Twiggy outside of this coffee shop. I am inside. I'm standing in line. I'm looking back. I'm checking to make sure she isn't moving. I order my beverage. I pay for my beverage. I'm looking outside. She's doing fine. She's kind of a nervous, tempered dog. Like, she's a little of a, like, she's got a little bit of a nervous Nelly in her. So when I go inside, she's always, like, at attention, like, waiting for me. Like, is he going to come back out? Is it over? Is he gone? You know, I don't think she quite gets it. But I'm standing there waiting for the barista to complete the preparation of my beverage. And I look outside, and this guy, you can picture him, okay? He's just like this guy. He's probably like 50. And he's got like a doodle. He's got like a labradoodle or a golden doodle, but he's a guy with a doodle. And he's walking his doodle on a leash, and he sees Twiggy, like, at attention, waiting for me outside, like a perfect angel. And he just, like, walks over, like, lets his dog, like, walk over and just get right up in her face. Meanwhile, he doesn't see me. He has no idea that I'm watching this. But he sees this dog, clearly on a sit stay waiting for her guardian, if I'm going to use the politically correct terminology. I'm not her owner. I'm her guardian. I'm her pal. And he sees this and just lets his dog come over and just get right up in her face, knocks her off of her stay. I don't blame Twiggy. I blame the doodle. I don't even blame the doodle. I blame the man. So I'm just like, what, dude? Why? It's not your dog. Get a clue. Like, what are you doing? Why is this a good idea? Why is this an acceptable behavior? I think, like, this is the thing. I think psychologically, he looked at Twiggy and was like, wow, that dog is really, you know, well-behaved. Someone's trained that dog. You know what I'm going to do? Because my dog isn't well-trained, I'm going to fuck that dog up. I'm going to knock it off its sits day.
Fuck you!
This is a dark human being. It's got problems. Needs to be addressed. Like, I don't know. Take some classes in basic etiquette. Read some books about life. Like I get that people like dogs. I get it. You like dogs, whatever. You like when your dog... Like, this is another thing that bothers me when people are like, can my dog say hi? No. I don't need your dog to say hi to my dog. Dogs don't need to say hi. Quit projecting your emotional needs onto your animal. They're not going to say hi. We're in the middle of a city. I'm walking. You want them to say hi? Like, let them say hi in a yard or something, or like on a farm. We are city people. These dogs do not need to say hello. Your dog is out of control and is pulling you. You're letting the dog pull you, and you're trying to justify this, you know, behavior by claiming that your dog needs to say hi. Your dog doesn't need to say hi. You need to train your dog. Sit down. Go away.
Fuck you!
My guest once again is Sarah McCall. Is that too extreme? Am I like a dog Nazi? Sarah McCall is my guest. Her memoir is called Joy Enough, available now from Live Right Press. Just a lovely book and just a lovely conversation with a very talented writer. Here she is, folks. This is Sarah McCall.
Well, I've tried answering this question many different ways. But I guess one of the ways that I think about it is that it's a book about trying to understand your parent outside their role as their parent to you. And for whatever reason, I was always very curious about my mother. She seemed like a very kind of cool and unknowable person to me. And people also said that we were alike. So that was sort of a bit of a mystery. You know, what does it mean to be told that you're like someone that you don't quite understand? So when she died, spoiler, I think I was trying to still understand, well, who's this person that I feel so bereft at having lost, that I'm apparently like, that I still kind of never got a satisfying answer completely about who she is. So, you know, I think of my nonfiction as being kind of motivated by, I want to discover something, I want to know something. So it started in that vein, I think.
Can I just say, I always marvel at this when I'm talking to memoirists who write these really vivid accounts of their childhood or past experiences. You have incredible memory for detail. Like, did this stuff, did you know that you had it, or did it come back up in the writing process? Were you surprised by how much you were calling up?
Well, I've always kept a diary. So some of it is not just pure recall. Some of it is, you know, I know that I wrote that day that a shed smelled like bicycle tires and hay. You know, I don't remember that. But I think I've always had a very visual memory. You know, you sort of remember things I remember things in moments, you know, very visually, like the scarf someone was wearing and what the weather was like. So I think that helped with rounding out scenic details. But yeah, I guess I have always thought I had a pretty decent memory. But then, of course, memory is so slippery and other people have ideas of what they remember and it completely conflicts with yours.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess I always say I have a terrible memory, but maybe I overstated in the opposite direction. It's just, it feels like remembering scenes from my childhood. I guess there are some. The sticky ones stick, I suppose.
The sticky ones stick. And then, yeah, I had some cheats. I mean, I had my own diary. And then I had this treasure trove that I found of my mom's. So she had written stuff about, you know, tie-dyeing things and dinner and dates with my dad and stuff like that. So I had access to her memories of things as well.
And what was that like?
Oh, great. I've always been a terrific snoop.
Okay. So yeah, it was like, I guess, you know, it's like, wow, this is who she really was.
Yeah.
And what's the harm in knowing?
Yeah, well, you know, my mom also had, like, throughout my entire childhood, this giant hat box in her closet filled with love letters from my dad. And so there was always kind of information that I could go through. And I did, you know.
Even as a child?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is that unusual? People snoop, like kids snooping through?
No.
Do you think your kids are snooping through your stuff?
I hope not, but I'm sure. I mean, I remember snooping as a kid. You're curious.
You're really curious.
I think that's why, I mean, I've said this many times, but I think that's a central motivation for me doing this show, is that I'm anticipating, and like, is this grandiose? But I'm anticipating my own death and like the unknowability of parent and child. And I want to leave something so my kids know who I was.
I think that's totally beautiful.
Because otherwise, I don't know, even if you're like close and you do a lot together and you have big talks, can you really know somebody? And maybe even after listening to all 600 of whatever, however many episodes I wind up creating, would even that be able to deliver a clear picture? But there's a frustration there, you know, and there's that desire to like want the people you love most to know you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think some people, well, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's a mother, because she was saying, oh my God, I remember when you came to my parents' house and you met them for the first time and you said, well, how did the two of you meet? She was like, my sisters and I were standing there like grossed out. Like, why would you ask this question of our parents? But I always want to know the stuff outside. Like, we only know each other right now in this relationship, in this room. But wouldn't it be cool to be able to access everyone else's relationship with you or your relationship with the outside world in some way? So, yeah, you can never really know someone, but you can snoop and you can ask a lot of rude questions.
You can go through their love letters.
Yeah, I ask a lot of questions too.
I do too. That's what I do.
Yeah, great job.
It is. And I think too, like, it's nice to... whoever it is, whether it's a parent or a family member or a friend or an acquaintance even, like, I like to have real communication.
Mm-hmm.
That goes beyond the superficial. I know that's like a kind of obvious thing to say, but I don't think it's that common in the world that we live in. And maybe that's just a function of, you know, day-to-day reality. You can't like get deep with the barista, you know, as much as you would like to, but it's like, I don't know. I guess I'm just saying I have a hard time with small talk.
I do too. And, I've been sort of realizing as this book has come out and I get to talk about, you know, people's loss and their great sadnesses, or people will tell me about their affairs or whatever, their marital problems. I've just been thinking, oh my God, if writing this book means that I never have to have small talk with a stranger again, I'm a genius.
Yeah. Like, just set yourself up.
This was the greatest gift I could ever give myself, because I think you're right. It's uncommon to have that desire for really getting in there, and people don't know how to do it necessarily. But I think often they're grateful when you do.
Depending on how you do it.
Yeah.
Like, you can be like the person on the airplane in like, you know, row 17 CD, who's just like getting too,
yeah,
you know, touchy feely or whatever. But I think that if you're open, like you're saying, like you have been in this book, and you kind of take that leap, it's a relief to other people.
Yeah.
It's a relief to be around an honest person who's vulnerable and open. But also fun and like not self-pitying.
Right.
It's like, you know, like it's hard. It's hard, especially if you're getting into difficult terrain not just in conversation, but also on the page.
Yeah.
And maybe especially on the page, to not veer into like solipsism or self-pity or negativity. And, you know, like,
and it's hard to know where that line is.
Oh my
right?
God. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure I know where that line is.
Well, clearly you do. Your book pulls it off.
Well, that's a tremendous relief, but, you know, but you always wonder, I guess what I've realized in this is that I have a lot of comfort with emotional life that I think maybe a lot of people don't. But what is honesty to me might be sentimentality to someone else. So I'm always like hugely relieved if no one thinks the book is sentimental, which it's about sentiment. It's about feeling. And it treats feeling, I think, as if feeling is important and interesting. But to some people that might be, whoa, too much, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, these things are like death and loss and the dissolution of relationships. It's tough stuff.
Yeah.
Not everybody has a high pain tolerance.
That's true.
And sometimes people, it's too close to the nerve or whatever. People have stuff that they've been through or are currently going through. And I think sometimes it's not the right timing.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Like, do you subscribe to any kind of idea about like how much time has to elapse between an event and the writing about the event?
No. I mean, I think some time is probably a good idea just because with time comes hopefully some perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it's, you know, but then again, sometimes writing like right when you're in it can yield, I think, a piece of work that has all this vitality and energy in it. And like, you know, it's kind of like roiling with grief and you can feel it. You know, sometimes that can work too. It just depends on the writer, you know, and the particular situation. For me, I think I'm the former and not the latter. I have a hard time seeing things clearly, even with time. And I think maybe I would benefit from being more immediate. Because I think like one of the things I struggle with is adjusting to new developments in life that feel like they're like bouncing me off the course that I was on. It changes my relationship to the work. It's like something else happens in life, especially something difficult. And suddenly it's like, oh, well, this isn't the book anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have that feeling as you were working on this?
Well, that's kind of like a narrative question about like when does it end or like what's the ending kind of. I don't know. I mean, no.
How long did it take you to write the book?
3 years.
Okay.
And some of it is written really from being really in the feelings of loss. But, you know, well, I guess the one way I think about it is that you have your intuitive writing brain where I do kind of think that your intuitive brain is smarter than what you think you're trying to do. So you just let that part write, which I did. But then there's your editing brain, which is much more, I don't know, maybe it has perspective or is thinking about themes, you know, things like that, that where you start to look at what you did and think, well, what am I doing here? But I think you need both. And I'm thinking about what you said about seeing something clearly. Like, what does it even mean to see an experience clearly? You know, do you see it, like, is it more clear because it's not roiling for you anymore? But then that seems to, like, say that distance and, like, a remove and an emotional kind of, I don't know, like, remove, basically, renders something clearer, as if, like, emotion can't be instructive or clear on its own.
That's true. I mean, I think sometimes anger can be blinding.
Yes.
But the other emotions, maybe not so much, maybe in fact, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking too, like in this revisionist way that maybe by allowing for all this time, you might be permitting yourself or opening yourself up to the intrusion of like your own narrative layers onto the experience. that wind up clouding it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, I think I do.
You start telling yourself stories about what happened that might not actually be what happened.
Right. Because like if I wouldn't have written this book if I'd waited another 2 years to start writing this book, because it wouldn't have been so, because some of it is just about that, what the experience of grief feels like. And I wouldn't have, I think the clarity that would have come from time was that I wasn't as interested in that experience of grief, but I was very interested in it at the time.
Yeah. How long ago did your mother die?
I think it's going to be 5 years in May.
Okay. So it was 5 years, and then the 3 years that you wrote it were pretty much immediately following?
Yeah, like started right away.
Okay.
Because she died and I went into graduate school, and that was a wonderful opportunity to just, you know,
pour it out.
Pour it out. Yeah. As my brother said, you know, are you in graduate school or are you in a 2-year grief program?
Well,
yeah.
I mean, either way.
But I mean, but that to me is like a great sadness actually about our culture. And I guess I realized that it was a luxury to fully enter and process and write and render my grief. But I wish that weren't a luxury. You know, I wish there were the time and the space and the cultural traditions or whatever that would let people do that.
Yeah. I mean, we hide our dying in America. We insulate ourselves from any vision of death as much as we can. As a culture, we're really not comfortable with it. I think other cultures around the world, mm-hmm. depending on where you are, it's much more a part of the fabric of reality. But in America, we don't get much prep.
No.
Nor do we get any kind of instruction manual, or I guess maybe in certain pockets of the country or certain cultural traditions, they might have a sort of protocol for the grieving process. But most of us are just kind of winging it.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm reading this book, actually, like, just as a matter of weird synchronicity, but it's called Being with Dying. Mm-hmm. And it's by Joan Halifax. And she did all this like palliative care work. She's a Buddhist nun, but she just like has spent many, many years of her life basically as a hospice worker, but like just being with dying. She's telling all these stories and it's intense.
Yeah.
And you were sort of in the role in your family as, you know, you took on a lot of caregiving, and that's a big job. It's gotta be frightening. Super intense, I would imagine, at times. Like, can you describe, I don't know, maybe the, like some of what you went through and some of what you learned from having to be at close range with this, with somebody so dear to you?
Yeah. I thought the experience, I think my mother and I both thought the experience of being very present with each other in that moment was very clarifying and very, I mean, it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but it felt like an experience of life to be in an experience of death. Like everything seemed so alive. You know, I took over her garden. You know, how do I grow radishes? How do I make sure the tomatoes like don't flop over or whatever? It was just very clarifying to be with someone who was so in love with life, kind of reckoning with the fact that it was ending and wanting to talk about what that meant, and also wanting to really be with the fact that she was still alive. And I found it like kind of exhilarating. You know, I had never felt more alive.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. I joke sometimes, but there's truth in the joke that some of my best moments in life have come at funerals.
Yeah.
Just because I feel a clarity and a realness with people, not just coming from me, but coming from them too. And, mm-hmm. and it's like a relief.
Yeah.
But there's also, I think, just the basic scientific truth that life and death are inextricable.
Yeah.
Like thousands or millions of our cells are dying right now as we speak. Like we're always dying. which is something that I don't think we necessarily remember. It's not like you're living, and then suddenly there's this moment of death. Like, there's kind of this dance going on all throughout a human life cycle or any life cycle.
Yeah.
And, you know, like death and birth, like the plants die and compost and other plants. You know what I'm saying?
I do. And I think that that's why, you know, having written a, quote, griefy book, I do have a sense of, I don't want to seem Pollyanna-ish or overly simplistic about, like, you know, a slapped on smiley face to the experience of death. But at the same time, they are so linked, the feeling of aliveness and the feeling of decay, that I sort of wish, I don't want people to just experience or think about books about death or grief as being depressing. That's kind of a frustration to me, or something I worry or hope that, you know, comes through. I mean, my book has a very bright yellow cover, and I think for a reason in some way. It's like,
and a giant smiley face on.
Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm, I do think they go together, and I think that, if at its best, it can feel like an invitation.
Did
right?
it surprise you that this was the case?
Yes, very much so.
Because I think in our minds, we have so much fear about losing the people we love. And I think in some way, it's the stories we tell ourselves and all that anxiety and those anxious thoughts and those imaginings of, oh my God, that might be in some ways, I don't want to say more difficult than actually losing somebody, but you know what I'm saying? Like, we hype these things up in our mind, and then you get inside the moment itself or the experience itself, and they're not necessarily in sync.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think probably what's uncomfortable is the avoidance of the experience. I think that feels like you're denying something that's really happening. So what felt really good, you know, a lot of people didn't want to talk to my mom about the fact that she was dying. And I think she didn't want to talk about it with a lot of people because
it's kind of a bummer.
They get, and people get weird, you know, yeah. And like,
it scares people.
And it scares people.
That's what it is. People, you know, when you're around the dying or the infirm, people who are unwell, I think it's a reminder of your own mortality.
Yeah.
And, but I guess I have some reverence for people who are in like palliative care professions or people who run towards people who are sick and infirm and dying versus moving away. Mm-hmm. I think they're rare. I think most of us are too overwhelmed. And I really wish that more of us weren't. And I very much want for myself to be one of those people. It's like one of these things I tell myself. I think that's why I'm reading this book. Like, I just don't want to be somebody who shrinks from human suffering. And I think that in the same breath, you have to say that it's not always pretty and it's not always graceful. Like some of us, you know, some of us handle being sick and dying better than others. Some of us handle the sufferings and the difficulties of life better than others. But all too often, the kind of suffering that people in palliative care professions or in any kind of caring profession are dealing with are people who are pissed off, mm-hmm. scared, angry, self-pitying, unstable. Like, it's hard,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think most people in the presence of that, even if they're willing to go there for a little while, eventually they're just like, I'm out.
Yeah.
And you need to stay in somehow.
I mean, I think what I'm realizing listening to you talk about it is that it's not like I had some very unique orientation. I think what it was a relationship of two people whose orientations complemented one another. Because I think if my mother had been very angry or avoidant or in denial, and she was angry about the fact that, like, she would order her bulbs, you know, to plant and then wouldn't have the energy to plant them. That made her angry.
Naturally so.
Yeah. But she was forthcoming about what that anger was about or the existence of that anger, as opposed to displacing it on something else. So I think her willingness to kind of be emotionally present allowed me to be emotionally present. But yeah, I mean, I think if people are dying and they have, or are sick or are going through, you know, just the illnesses of watching our bodies just atrophy and
like, sucks, right?
Sucks so bad. Yeah, I wouldn't have had that experience.
Did it take some of your fear away to have gone through this, like to face it? You know, you had to face losing your mother. You had to watch that process, watch that like decay. I think at one point in the book, you talk about how she aged like 20 years and 6 months.
Yeah.
That's hard to watch.
Yeah.
You know, and hard to go through. But like, did you come away with any greater degree of, I don't know, peace or serenity or acceptance around it? Or is that just kind of Pollyanna-ish?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's made me very corny. Like, you know, I was in yoga the other day and the teacher kept talking about being in our embodied forms. And I was like really feeling my body in the room and in the postures. And then I was like, God, I love being embodied. I love my embodied life. And then I realized it would not always be embodied and it would end. And then I started weeping and then I couldn't stop weeping for the rest of the class, which felt great because it was like, you know, it's kind of a gift to remember that and to arrive in the place of being grateful for being in your body. And then also to realize that it won't be that way forever.
And it could end at any moment.
Yeah.
Like any moment and any day, you know, you just don't know. There are no guarantees and easy to forget that or avoid thinking about it.
But also like, you know, with the Buddhists, like we can't live in a constant state of like, oh my God, this moment. Oh my God, this moment. Like
right.
it's too much. Constant state of rapture. Like that would be so annoying, A. And B, you know, mostly it would just be very annoying. Like who wants to get a drink with that person? But even just some of it, even just more of that feeling, I kind of am grateful for and I welcome.
It's like an equilibrium.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to be with the person who like can't break eye contact. Who's just like a little bug eyed in the waiting room at yoga.
Yeah.
Like, we get it. You're present, you know? But, you know, what I found is I think the people who have, like, the most comforting vibe to me, it's less that. There's, like, I don't know. It's, like, I think there's a little bit more sadness and vulnerability mixed with, like, a wistfulness and good humor. You know what I'm saying? It's like a blend.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that we're talking about is, like, where it's, like, cranked up to 11 in one direction. And the other direction's not so great either, where the person's just, like, morose and
right, no,
fatalistic. That doesn't work either.
Yeah.
So it's like some like nice balance of like the polarities or, you know, this blend of experiences in life that we have. And I don't know. It's nice to be around somebody who's embodying that.
Yeah. A friend of mine calls it the fleetings. You know, when you're going along and you're having like a nice I'm alive feeling, and then you have the dawning realization of it being able to end at any moment. And it's bitter. It's both at once. It's so beautiful and it's totally depressing, but I love that he calls it the fleetings.
That's
because
great.
It's like the best. It, that is that equilibrium moment that I think it's like when it dawns on you, it's like, it's good. You know, well, it is bittersweet, but it's good.
Well, I agree. And it's like, it makes me think of like, you know, all this talk of enlightenment and, is it like a sustained thing or is it something that's like a constant, you know, it's an ongoing process rather than some place you get to. And is anybody out there really sustaining this? I guess maybe there are some rare humans who can do it, but I sure haven't met one.
No, hell no. And like, do you, have you ever listened to Tara Brach?
Sure.
Yeah. Love Tara. But she talks about remembering and forgetting and remembering and forgetting. And for me, like, that's totally what life is. And sometimes, like, to a very humiliating degree, like, oh my God, I've been realizing, quote unquote, realizing the same thing over and over again since I was 7.
Like, how many times do I have to learn this fucking lesson?
Yeah, exactly. But I guess forever is the answer. Yeah. Like, literally forever.
Well, and you tell me, like, just the humiliation I can feel to just keep failing, you know? Like, am I making progress in life? Am I getting a handle on this? Is there any handle to get? Like, what? How do you do it, you know? And it's just that feeling of exasperation I can sometimes feel, especially when I'm having a not-so-great day, or I fuck something up, mm-hmm. or just do something stupid, or I get angry. It's just like, I don't know. It's hard.
Are you a perfectionist, though?
I mean, maybe a little bit. I mean, I've been working on the same book for more than a decade. That's probably some perfectionism. But yeah. Like, I don't know. I am kind of like, I'm a creature of habit. I think if you looked at my like day to day, you'd be like, holy shit. It doesn't feel like I'm that crazy. I mean, I don't know.
Wait, why would I be like, holy shit?
Like, it's just like, wow. Like, this guy's, I get up at 4:30.
Wow. And, no, that wow.
Yeah. But it's the only time I have. I try to like, it's not because I'm like, I don't feel like super, like I've had conversations lately around ambition. And I'm just like feeling this sort of like blah feeling about the work world and like what to do and right livelihood and like how to balance it all and how to do something that you don't feel like is toxic and how to like take care of practical concerns without getting swept up into like this mad chase after money. And it's just like, it's hard to navigate all that stuff. And a friend of mine was like, I forget what I said, but I said something along the lines of, wanting to do something, make a positive difference. You know, speaking in that vein. God, this is sounding terrible. But then he was like, oh, so you are ambitious. And I was like, oh yeah, like I am, but you have to be ambitious for the right things, I think. Mm-hmm. Or that's what I want. I don't want to be ambitious for the wrong things.
Right.
And it's trying to like suss those two things out. And like, can you be ambitious for the quote unquote right things while at the same time being effective in the economic system that we live in? They seem to be at cross purposes so often in my life and in my reading, and it's like, well, how do I thread this needle?
Yeah, I mean, capitalism bad.
Like, it's hard. It's,
yeah,
it compromises us. And I don't know, like, Winston Churchill, I could be totally botching this, but I want to say like Winston Churchill or someone like him said something like, it's like the least worst system that man has devised. I have to believe we can do better.
I know.
I want to imagine, like, can we imagine different modes of living where things are a bit more equitable and people are happier and people have, like, just as an example, to go back to what you were saying about the grieving process. Like, oh, when you lose someone significant, that we would have, I don't know, some sort of ritual or time allowed, or I don't know.
Well, in some ways, I think even though the gig economy has so many problems.
Including the name gig economy.
Yeah, I think you're right there. The branding is bad. But, you know, like a friend of mine who's a poet and makes a living as a poet and a teacher, she said, I'm trying to organize my life so that I no longer work when I have my period. And I was like, well, oh, like, great. You know, that's a great idea. Or if there are ways in which you can structure your life so that your work life works for you in some basic ways. But the other thing that I was thinking about ambition is, how do you navigate getting a little bit of success for your ambition, being somehow rewarded for your ambition, and then not get kind of steered off into a nefarious zone of like, this is taking me in the wrong direction. This is taking me away from why I'm actually ambitious or something.
It's easy to slide off the path.
Yeah.
You know, until all of a sudden you're like, wait, what am I doing?
Yeah.
So you have to have like a watchful eye. And like, I think about, I was thinking about this as I was reading this Joan Halifax book, but, it's like the Buddha, he abandoned his wife and child to go on this quest. So I'm sort of thinking about that in like a modern context. Like I would never do that.
Right.
But like, that's kind of hardcore. I guess he was a prince and like they had a palace to live in and he didn't, they weren't like just destitute, like begging for food. Do you know what I'm saying? But it's like, what would he do or someone like him if he were in my shoes?
Oh God. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Well, don't they talk about like the big boat and the little boat or something like that, where it's like, there's the enlightenment that, or there's the enlightenment quest where you go off and you seclude yourself and you cast off your worldly concerns, including your wife and children. But then there's the, I think it's the little boat, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm probably completely messing this up. But where you stay, you know, in the boredom and mundane realities of daily life, and you're still working on the same questions of enlightenment and appreciation and meaning. And mostly though, it's just hard to cultivate a life around meaning when there's so many like crude, distracting, like garbagey things competing for your attention.
Well, and also the models of success that we are constantly being shown are not typically rooted in a search for deeper meaning.
Yeah.
Like even in the writing realm.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like a quest for fame and status and the right reviews and the right, like you, I see, especially in, you know, the social media context, which is where people self-present and curate. Mm-hmm. And, but then, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like a necessary evil, but I find myself like sometimes being like, you know, it's hard not to fall into like, oh God, like I got to do this.
Yeah.
And then it's like, do I want that? Is it the right thing to want? Is this really where it's at? And then I'll read some like wisdom book or hear some like wise person talking in a documentary film and they'll be like, and then, you know, one day I looked around and I was in my mansion in Malibu and I realized I was still unhappy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's, you know what I'm saying? It's like, don't we, what's the project here? Are we trying to be superficially happy or are we trying to actually be happy?
It's weird because like even with, I have, as I'm sure we all do, a strange relationship with social media, but then, you know, here I am, a debut author, and I feel like part of my job is to do the best job I can on social media promoting my book. And on one hand, that feels gross. And on the other hand, I'm sort of like, well, you know, that's just what's required. And that's what people are doing. And I'll try to do it in the most, like,
annoying.
The most annoying way possible.
Just own it.
Well, you know, yeah, it's just annoying.
But it's not, I mean, it is and it is. And I guess it depends how you do it. But I think at this point, it's just the water we're swimming in. I think most people accept that.
But I think that's like what I am suddenly also kind of aware of, where it's like, do we even have to be swimming in this water? Like, what about the writers who just aren't on social media, you know, and they're just off, whatever. They're actually writing.
Right.
They're not hashtagging am writing. They are.
I know. But it's like a lot of, I should say, just like I always, because I always throw up this flag. It's like a lot of those people have a readership that pays them a living.
Yeah.
They don't need to be. It's a luxury to not need to be on social media, like rattling your cup for readers.
Yeah.
But then there are people, like I was thinking just yesterday, it was like Edward P. Jones came up in my head just as an example. Like, I think he, you know, he's published well, he won the Pulitzer Prize. He's not fucking around on social media. Mm. He wasn't even before. I don't think he ever would, even if his book hadn't, you know, there are writers, I think, who just would never even think to do it.
Right.
And maybe some of that is generational. Maybe some of it is temperamental, but I can't help but like sort of wish for myself that I were like one of those people who just was completely off. I'm only on Twitter, which I feel like smug about. I'm only on one. The rest of you fools spend even more time curating your lives on all these different platforms. But I think eventually like the goal is to remove myself from it.
Really? You want to get off?
I think so. I think after, I mean, I don't know. I go back and forth. It's just a tool. It depends how you use it. Mm-hmm. I get that whole argument, but at the very least, like a long break just to see how I feel in the absence of it. Like not like a month, but like a couple years.
Wow.
You know, like really take some time and like think about what the differences are. And I don't know.
Well, just like quality of attention kind of changes, right? Like the more you're not in that quick hit world. I mean, I don't know. I think about the writing that I do when I'm at a writing residency. Mm-hmm. And I'm always trying to recreate what feels like that brain space in my normal life, where I just need a lot of room in my brain to be able to do the work that I want to do. And normal life, you know, your day is carved up into components. At some point you're going to be grocery shopping, then you're looking at your phone. So I don't know.
I look at my phone while I grocery
shop. Yeah, me too. The list is on there. So I don't know. And so I'm in a constant state of frustration about how do I make regular life feel more like optimum creative life. But that doesn't seem like very generous to myself, because it's like, well, optimum creative life is that, because that's what it's designed for. And regular life is something else.
It is. But it's, I mean, to do this work in the context of regular life, as most all of us have to, you have to create the conditions, like however imperfectly, to do the work. Like you have to have a room of your own or whatever, or like a coffee shop of your own or a library cubicle or whatever it is.
Do I have to wake up at 4:30?
Do you have kids?
No.
When you have kids, you might. I just, like, the thing is, it's not some, like, you know, austerity that I'm imposing on myself because I'm some crazed, like, type A person, I don't think. I think it's more like just coming to grips with the fact that if I don't do it then, if I don't get up then, doing, like, the me time and, mm-hmm. like, the self-care that I want to do would otherwise happen when my wife and kids are awake. And then it sort of makes it feel more selfish.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, we're all going to watch a movie. And I'm like, well, dad's going to go, you know, in the garage for an hour and a half and, mm-hmm. you know, or go to a spinning class or whatever it is, you know? And I like it. I like having that time. Plus in the context of a big city, just having the quiet, I like being up and seeing the sunrise.
Mm.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's a good time. It's just that it works for me. Am I exhausted sometimes? Yeah. Like it can wear on you. It depends on what you're doing. But if you go to bed early, it's okay.
I'm just so impressed. And I'm always like jealous a little bit of the people who can do this, because I just feel, I mean, surely all writers, we must be more disciplined than we think we are, even when, you know, things are not like, I'm not waking up at 4:30 because I am getting the work done, but morning people get an extra sort of badge of honor. You know what I mean? Like
you have a little bit more time because you do wind up staying up a little later. Like once you're up, and you know, it's not like I go to bed at 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
I go to bed at like between 10 and 11. I don't get as much sleep, but like, I don't know. It's working for me right now, but it's interesting that I don't get up at 4:30 and immediately write. I get up at 4:30 and I meditate for like a half an hour to an hour. And I go exercise, which, I like to do just to like get outside, clear my head. It does something to me like neurochemically because
mm-hmm.
I'm not on pills. I don't go to therapy. Like that's it for me,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's like how I like sort of set myself, but it takes me longer to get to the page. I feel like maybe if I were really like a disciplined artist, I would just be getting up and like having coffee and like making the writing the first thing.
I don't know. Also, why are we always just like feeling like we're doing it wrong? You know,
yeah.
Like, I don't know. My mom, I think one of her gifts was kind of just like making people feel like they were doing a good enough job. And especially around motherhood, like I watched her have a lot of conversations with mothers who are always feeling like they're messing up or not doing enough. And any time they take for themselves is bad for the kids. And my mom would just be like, you know what? they're loved, you made dinner, or maybe you didn't make dinner, but they ate something. Like, it's fine. Go take a bubble bath. You're doing a great job. And that's what I wish we had more of in our culture and in my friendships and in my relationships. It's just everyone kind of telling each other, like, you know, we don't have to self-flagellate endlessly, actually. Like, you're doing a good job. Like, you've got hundreds of episodes of a podcast. You're doing the work. You're a good dad. Like, you're a good partner. Like, yeah. All this stuff. Like, yeah. I guess it sounds corny, but, like, if the outcome's going to be the same and we're either just going to feel bad about ourselves along the way or feel kind of okay, some of the time at least, like, why not? Can't we just feel better about ourselves?
Just lay out, like, lighten up a
little
bit.
Up.
It's not bad advice. And I think that, you know, it's like trying to find, again, the balance between that mode and maybe being too permissive, or like, mm-hmm. we're all patting each other on the back,
yeah.
while the kids are starving, you know, genuinely neglected. But I think in this culture, you know, like Los Angeles immediately, America,
mm-hmm.
but then just like people in general, you know, we do put an incredible amount of pressure on ourselves. And I think maybe, you know, like what we're being shown and by the culture, the models of success that like we were talking about earlier, it makes you feel like you have all this stuff to live up to. And I don't know how much of it's real.
Yeah. And like, so what if you don't live up to this idea? Like, so what?
Yeah.
I don't know. I say this as if I have internalized all of this, but I haven't. It's just that it's my work, I think. It's part of my work is...
Well, it's a nice legacy that your mother gave you.
Yeah.
Is to be a person who can make people feel that, because people, you know, they could use some of that.
Yeah. And it's not like... It's like probably the people in your life... They're trying really hard. You try really hard, you know? So it's not like I am being overly permissive by saying like, it's cool. You're fine. You know, I know how, like, just looking at you right now, like, you care, you know, you care a lot.
If the people listening could only see my facial expression right now, the amount of caring pouring out of me. So your book, you know, you're dealing with loss, but there's like, they're twin narratives. It's the loss of your mother and it's the loss of a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So these things were happening concurrently.
Yeah. At the same time. And, I think, you know, what I was saying earlier about the sense of aliveness in the face of death, it also kind of reflected back on my marriage where I thought, oh, well, this relationship that I have with my mother, this is intimacy and this is fun and this is connection. And I guess I don't really have those feelings so much anymore with my husband.
Yeah. It's like relationships, intimate relationships with a partner long-term, there's all these ebbs and flows and it's just the nature of things.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's the beginning, which is beautiful. You're falling in love. It's exciting. You're getting to know one another. And then, you know, I guess it's different for everybody. Like, didn't George Burns and Gracie Allen just like have like, wasn't it just perfect the whole time? They're just joking and smoking or something. But I don't know. I guess like, so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it. Like at some point you realize like this just isn't working. The feeling is mutual and it's time to split and move on. That happens in life with human beings. Do you ever think to yourself, like, maybe we should have stayed and like just let it be sort of boring and bad for a while and maybe it would have come back around? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, when's the point to jump?
I do. I think probably this is extra hard for people who are really seeking and love that intensity of living, is when things are kind of in their lulls, to just ride it out. And I was very aware of that in the time, at the time. Or I thought, you know, maybe this is just a bad stretch and we'll get to the other side and it'll be better. But, I, you know, I guess I'm grateful to my ex-husband, given that he was the one who was sort of like, I'm going to call it, you know, this is over. And because I was still kind of, I don't know, you know, like we loved each other and maybe we can love each other like that again. But the fact that, talk about the two narratives reflecting on each other, the fact that I was in such grief about the loss of my mother, and I really never experienced a grief about the end of the marriage. I mean, I did, but it had been dead for a long time, so the grief process was very different. It was more sad to have shared such a long period of my life with someone who then was not a part of my life anymore. That was very sad. But I didn't feel that like rapture of mourning or like that intense sense of loss over the marriage that I had over my mother.
Well, it's not as deep of a connection.
Yeah.
Not as much time.
Yeah.
You know, it's just different.
But do you find that like it's hard to, I have trouble with the like down moments, like remembering that like, okay, it's not always going to be like a parade or like, you know, some intense thing. Sometimes you're just getting up and going through the day.
I mean, this is like, I'm not one to give advice, but like whenever, like the best advice I've ever been given about relationships is like, just don't talk when you're angry or upset. And I don't always follow it. But it's like, just wait.
Yeah.
Like, go for a walk. Like, that's the nature. Like, you're going to be annoyed. It's a, you know, and it comes back around. I guess the foundation has to be there. There has to be a real intimacy and depth of connection and solidity, you know, to sustain it. But I just don't believe, I guess, in this sort of romantic notion of a really long relationship between two human beings, man, woman, woman. I don't care what it is. That doesn't come with some turbulence or ups and downs or periods where things are better or worse or whatever. You know, I just think that's part of it.
Yeah.
And accepting that as just reality and sort of going back to that, particularly when, you know, it's just you're in one of those moments or you're having one of those days, has an anchoring effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, there's evidence for it. It's like, well, you know what? If you just take a breath or take a walk or just go to bed, you wake up, it's a new day.
Mm-hmm.
And it bounces back. I often have the thought with my wife where I'm like, well, you know, she's seen me at my worst, my absolute worst, and she's still here, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel an enormous amount of gratitude. I think people in marriages or relationships, you have to feel that, because inevitably over time you're going to show yourself to somebody. You can only hide for so long.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that's just really it. But you're always making it up as you go along. And I was lucky to have good mom. My parents are still married. Her parents were married until her dad died. So I think like that kind of helps, just to have a model, but doesn't guarantee anything.
I think that helps a lot.
I think so too.
Yeah.
You know, and like your parents split up.
Yeah.
So do you think that was unhelpful, or did that contribute to, you think, the dissolution of your marriage?
I think, I think in some ways I felt more motivated to stay married because I, you know, before my mom died, the worst thing that ever happened in my life was when my parents got divorced. I mean, these are not horrible things, but I mean, they are, but.
How old were you?
I was 10.
Okay.
So I remember feeling like telling my mom on the phone, like, I'm so sorry. Like, I feel bad that I failed. She's, you know, it's not a failure. And she was sort of reassuring about that. But I think my parents also had a very intense relationship. So,
well, I mean, a hat box full of love letters.
Yeah, right.
When you said that, I was like, I better start writing.
Yeah.
My wife needs some letters.
Oh, my God. More love letters.
It was because we live in this fucking horrible digital age. It's all like, you know, AOL instant messengers. They're somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they would write messages to each other. My dad would get his shirts sent to the cleaners and then extra starched, like extra, extra starched. And then they would have a piece of cardboard in the middle and they would write notes to each other on the piece of cardboard and lean it up against the sink, you know. Aww. Very sweet. Yeah, very sweet. But I feel like that was a condescending aw. But anyway, what's my point? Yeah, love letters. I didn't want to fail at marriage. Yeah, so intensity. So I think they modeled intensity. So what I'm, I think, trying to learn in my adult life is like, oh, actually, like real romance is, or it's part of romance is day-to-day alignment and...
Like, what does a healthy relationship look like?
Oh, my God.
Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like these big questions, but I guess it's worth asking because there are, like, there are relationships that are really fucking healthy, I'm sure. I don't know too many people who I'm like, wow, like, this is a glowing couple mm-hmm. who's been together for 20 years or however long. Though, I guess, you know what? My parents have been together for almost 50 years and, like, they fucking get along.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like Ward and June Cleaver, you know? And you're just like, what the fuck? They only dated for 3 months and got
wow.
Me, you know? So, I mean, I don't know. I guess you... What's the other thing I always hung on to as a piece of advice? Like, try not to talk when you're upset. And, oh, and then, like, this... I think this notion of each person in the couple... having as their primary orientation, like, what can I give versus, like, what can I get?
Yeah.
And when there are imbalances, it's where a person is like, I'm not getting what I need versus, like, are you okay?
Right.
But sometimes, you know, like, it's just sometimes the person who's, like, I'm not getting what I need is, like, being sort of selfish,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so things can get sort of tilted, and that can put a strain on things.
Yeah. And I think your question earlier about like, how do you know when it's over or like to, when to let go or whatever? How do you know that the compromises you're making are the right ones? That's something maybe sometimes things don't feel right or your needs aren't being met. But I guess your point is maybe whomever shouldn't be thinking about whether or not our needs are being met and just like think about the other person's needs more.
But it's got to be mutual.
Right. Otherwise, then it's really messed
up. Otherwise, then it's like, well, yeah, then you're doing too much. And it's like this constant, feeding of the beast where the other person's getting all this attention lavished on them, but you're not getting what you need. And it's just, it's an imperfect,
yeah,
you know, like teeter totter or whatever.
I guess you just have to, this is where it's like, you have to really hope that you chose someone who like, has the same levels of generosity, but also like healthy selfishness and, you know, all the things. Frankly, to me, it's a miracle that two people ever like each other at the same time.
Right.
Make it work at the same time, like put their bodies in the same place and space at the same time. Like, how long have you been married?
I have been married. It will be 12 years this summer.
Wow.
It's gone so fast.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's been, and we've known each other, you know, we've been together for 14. I can't believe that much time has gone by. It doesn't seem like, you know, like that much time, but.
But that's good. I mean, that clearly means something feels right and is good.
Yeah. No, it's like, but I think too, you know, people fall into the trap, I think it's a natural human inclination to wonder or to think, especially when you're younger or you're single and you're out like dating, like there's going to be this perfect person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, certainly I feel like my wife is like perfect for me. You know, there is that feeling of like, oh, I found someone. But like, if you're being like purely like mathematical about it, or if she were being purely mathematical about it, there've got to be like lots of human beings
right.
in the world that like you could couple with. I don't know. I think it's pretty romantic to think there's just one in 7 billion or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess it's just like, I guess the point that I'm driving at is that sometimes I think in relationships, it can be tempting to think that there's a more perfect situation out there in the world. And there is that mathematical one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That hasn't been my experience. I don't spend much time thinking about that because I'm sort of feel like I found my person, but it, I think it's fairly common
that people think that.
Yeah, or just like measuring it against some ideal, like measuring just like the messy reality of what is versus like some idealized version of what should be. And again, I think the culture shows us models like these curated relationship reality shows or, you know, romantic comedies or whatever that give you this presentation of what love and intimacy look like that isn't really close. But it's like quite lovely to like watch, you know, like I was watching Silver Linings Playbook the other night. I was putting my 3-year-old son to bed. He's like, let's watch a movie. And I just opened up my Netflix and it was there. Suddenly I'm like watching this movie, like totally getting into it. He's watching it. I'm like, is this okay for him? It's like Jennifer Lawrence is like shrieking and like knocking the, you know, remember the scene where she like knocks the food off the, I'm like, maybe I don't want him learning this. But such a good movie. It like made me feel so good. I was like, oh, and that's kind of like a pretty, I think, authentic romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Like complicated characters, not like this sort of like, you know, like starry-eyed version of the thing. But I don't know. I think that can kind of mess us up is that we just don't have necessarily a clear understanding of what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah.
To be in an intimate relationship with somebody.
Yeah. And that like, there's so much focus on this one romantic relationship. I mean, I think in some ways what's kind of maybe a little transgressive about my book on some level is that it's a love story, but it's not a love story about matrimonial love or sexual love. It's about my mom's love of me and my love of her. And that is its own kind of, you know, great love story.
Oh yeah. And like, I should say too, like you did such a, like your mom's so cool.
She's pretty cool.
Yeah. And like, but I mean like to have rendered her on the page like this, and you didn't do any of this writing when she was still alive. Like, did she ever get to read any of your writing about her?
No.
Well, regardless, like, I just think it's lovely that you put her on the page like this. And that someone like me can pick up the book and just be like, oh, like at the end of it, I was like, I miss her. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like I know her and I like her so much. And you made it clear, you know, you painted her beautifully.
Thanks. That's always the best compliment, you know, when someone says, I loved your mom. Yeah. I wish you were my mom or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I also feel that my romantic relationships always seem to need a lot of ancillary relationships. Like I am kind of social, you know, I like having the friend that I talk about writing with and the friend that likes daiquiris as much as I do. And
the daiquiri friend is always
the daiquiri friend's important, you know? So anyway, just like that, it takes a lot of relationships and in this case, you know, yeah, man, now I'm feeling like, yeah, I miss her.
Well, I mean, you know, it's, you stick around long enough, you're going to miss some people.
My God, this is, you don't go to therapy, but my therapist said to me the other day, Sarah, all relationships are impermanent. And I said, I am so mad at you right now for saying that.
Yeah.
He was like, dude, I'm right there with you.
It's so easy to forget.
Yeah.
It's so easy to forget. And then you sort of like spend some time reflecting on it. And I like, you'll have this like catch. I'll have this catch in my breath where it's like, oh shit.
It's panicky,
you know, especially around my kids. And it's just like, you just don't know. And yet I think that the thing to do is to cherish and to, you know, really try to wring as much as you can out of like every day.
Yeah.
That's the project. It's not simple to do. It's so easy to get distracted. And, like what weren't you saying it either? It's like earlier, the Tara Brach thing, it's like remembering and forgetting.
Yeah.
Remembering and forgetting. I fall into forgetting so easily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, I call it sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go for all these hikes, you know, my pre-dawn ritual or whatever. And I always like marvel and am troubled when I have one of these mornings where like I'm like halfway down after going up to the top when I suddenly realize like I'm on a hike.
Yeah.
And I've spent like the first like hour and 10 or whatever it is, you know, however long I'm hiking, like just, I don't know, in some sort of trance, like reliving something or freaking out about something or litigating some mm-hmm. past, you know, like all the things that we do in our brains, and you just miss the whole thing or most of it. But I guess the catching is good. You know, at least I'm aware that I've, you know, that I was sleepwalking. At some point you wake up a little bit.
I think that itself is the practice, right? You know, catching yourself. Because you can't, yeah, you can't live. I don't know anyone who's like living in a constant state of this precious moment.
Well, but it's also not, we're not living in an environment, living as an mm-hmm. example in Los Angeles, that's conducive to it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why all these monks and nuns of the world live in these like remote monasteries, you know, up in the Himalayas or wherever. And it's like, oh, well, it's much easier when it's fucking dead quiet. There's no phones, you know, it's like the writing retreat.
Yeah.
Like suddenly it's like, oh my God, I just wrote like 25,000 words in 10 days.
Yeah.
And they're good words,
right?
You know, and it's because you had a moment to quiet yourself. But it's just hard to, I mean, unless you're living in some kind of contemplative existence or like, you know, my patron saint, I always joke like it's like Montaigne. That's all I want.
Hmm.
But it'll be this garage instead of a tower. A lot of sweatpants. But he was like this rich French nobleman. He had a fucking, you know, inheritance and all this land and like people cooking for him and shit. It's like, well, of course.
Right.
I think he had people cooking for him, but it was like clearly like a blessed life. You know, he didn't have the normal everyday concerns that we all have. So he didn't have to.
Right.
Maybe one day, you know, I'll have that life. I like to imagine that I would get so much done, but it's hard when you're in a city or in just everyday human existence to not get swept up, you know, either by your computer or by, you know, traffic or whatever it is that we, you know, the grocery store.
And maybe what we need to do is like reframe it, you know, so that, and I guess this is what I was trying to say earlier. Like, I don't want to live constantly wishing that I could make my life more like a writing retreat because I will never succeed at that goal. So that seems like a bad one to take up. But maybe there's a way to like, and I don't know what this would look like, but reframe the daily life stuff so that it's punctured with like ways to catch ourselves, you know?
Well, they say, and that's the thing about Zen practice. It's like, you know, it's not just when you're sitting on the cushion
right.
or you're on retreat. It's like when you're at the grocery store,
yeah.
when you're walking the dog, when you're washing the dishes, it's like the normal everyday stuff. You're supposed to imbue that and make that the stuff of practice. And I like that because it makes it accessible and it's like a reminder. It's like, oh yeah, there doesn't have to be this perfect set of circumstances
right.
in order for, you know, me to be able to do this. But it's definitely, I think the harder version of it. It's much easier when you have like a quiet room.
Yeah. Well, even in writing, like I would like to get back into the habit of, oh, if I have an idea right now, I'm just going to stop and jot it down on my phone or something. But I'm very out of the habit of that. You know, it's more like I will be in my studio. The birds will be chirping. I'll have my cup of coffee.
If I don't have birds, I'm not fucking writing.
No way, man. That's a non-starter.
They got to be nice like doves, too. I want like peaceful bird song accompanying. Was this book over the course of 3 years? I imagine all books are hard to write. But writing about something that's like so close to the bone emotionally and just like difficult loss, was it like passing a kidney stone or was it like cathartic release of emotion and memory or some combination?
I think that part of it in the writing was pleasurable in some sense because like I was really not ready to not be in relationship with my mother anymore. And so it kept her very alive to me to be writing about her. But on the other hand, I knew she wasn't alive and I would be like weeping at my desk all afternoon. So yeah, I think it was painful and it was, never had a kidney stone, but it was like, you know, really wringing out.
I'm just going to knock on
yeah,
wood.
Thank you. I should have done that myself. But yeah, it was like wringing out an experience. But like, I would take that any day over sleepwalking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
go into it. Like the way through is
yeah,
through.
Yeah. And that I guess is in the end, like why I could take some, like I liked the grieving process and why I'm glad that I just saturated myself in it for 2-3 years. And because I would rather feel something than nothing. And even the feeling, the deep feeling of a bad feeling is better than no feeling. And
or the repression of a feeling.
Or the repression of a feeling.
Isn't going to make it go away.
And I think also like to the, what we were saying earlier about death and life going together, you know, a bad feeling, it's kind of just like another form of endurance training for good feelings, right? Like it's all just stretching you out and making more room for more feelings about things and more experiences and emotional experience. So I guess I was into it, but
you let yourself have it.
Yeah.
It's healthy.
I did.
I mean, it's okay to grieve the loss of a parent.
Yeah.
You know, and to do it on your own clock.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, I mean, I know, I guess in some cultures, it's like you have the period of mourning where you wear the certain clothes or perform certain rituals or something like that. That's kind of cool. I think mm-hmm. having like you were saying at the top of the conversation, you know, wishing that we had maybe something like that, some version of that in yeah. American culture. And maybe it's, you know, it's here and there, but it's certainly not like broadly embraced.
Like a black armband that just like signifies, hey, like, I don't want to talk about you, like, you know, sleep training your kid or whatever. I don't have that in me right now because I am grieving.
Yeah. This know? Is my black don't fuck with me armband. None of your bullshit.
None of your bullshit.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, I have a friend who just lost her husband, like tragically. They have 3 kids. And I just been thinking about them. And, you know, like they're just on my brain because, like, holy yeah. shit, what a horrible thing to happen. And I haven't seen her since the funeral. And I just saw her for the first time. I ran into her on the street. And I was just like, you know, like, what do you say?
Yeah.
So it's like, that's also a challenge. As somebody who doesn't want to be the person who shies away, then you go to somebody who's going through something. And what I said was like, I gave her a hug and I said, I've been thinking about you. You've been on my mind. And she said, I know. And she's like, give my love to your family. It was very quick.
Yeah.
And then I put my hands like this, you know, the pressed hands together, like in prayer. I don't do that. I'm not the guy who does that. But I like,
you're
sort
like,
of
namaste on the street.
I did a namaste. Like reflexively, you know, like not habitually. I never do that. And then afterwards I was like, why did I just namaste her? Like, did she think I'm lame? And I started like, but it was just like, I just felt so much emotion. I was like,
yeah,
I just wanted to like visually signal to her, like something, you know,
yeah.
I don't know how else to do it. Like what, I don't know what else I was going to do. The sign of the cross or
yeah,
shadow puppet, you know, like, but that's what I did. And I hope it was okay. And I think that when you are in the presence of somebody who's grieving, like my mom told me, because I had a friend who lost a parent and a brother when I was growing up, had like a double loss, like tragically both. And but they were not at the same time. They were staggered by like 4 or 5 years. And I'll never forget my mom saying to me in conversation, because I was like, I don't know what to do
mm-hmm.
for Timmy. Like, I was like, what do I do? And she was like, something.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, like, I think sometimes people err on the side, well, I don't know what to say or do, so I'm just going to say nothing so that I don't fuck anything up.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for the person who's grieving, and maybe you can speak to this, like in the year or 2 or 3 or whatever, where you were writing this book and going through your grieving process, did you ever find yourself thinking like, God, I wish somebody would fucking call me and like ask how I'm doing? Or did you feel like there was too much of that? You know, like sometimes I wonder if, like, for example, my friend who just lost her husband is sitting at home, like, lonely, mm-hmm. and is going like, wow, people are not coming to rally around me the way that I wish that they were. Or is she thinking like, guys, I just need space. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know, you know?
And I guess you can ask her, right? Like,
yeah,
I think that's the thing, is that people are afraid of what to say or do, and so sometimes, like, they just don't ask you, you know, and I guess you don't want to put it on the other person too much, like, what do you need right now or whatever, but
it's like, do I just show up with food? And then it's like, but they probably have food. They're just like, then she won't have any room in the fridge, and it just gets annoying.
I don't know. I think that, like,
gestures are nice,
and no one brings on. I mean, actually, that is really lovely. Like, people don't really bring food to each other, I think, unless you live in, like, a very kind of traditional, you know, folksy kind of, like, you know, neighborhoody vibe.
There's like a hot dish.
Yeah, that's not
sorry
really
about
happening
your grandpa.
But, like, it is just a nice gesture.
I think those gestures matter, even if, like, you don't eat the food.
Yeah. You don't like hot dish.
Yeah, you're like, fuck, I'm gonna quietly dump this in the garbage can, but I'm like, touched that they brought it by. Like, I think people need to feel that you care.
Yeah.
And, like, see that you care. And I don't know. It's just trying to navigate that. It's like, I think more dialogue is always better, just so that people, like you say, why not just ask?
Yeah, just ask. And what would make me mad, and I had a friend whose mother died, like, very shortly after my mother died, and I loved her telling me all the things that made her mad. Like, it would make her so mad if someone was like, I know your mother would have been so proud of you, or like anything like that, where she's like, shut up. Like,
shut the fuck up.
Yeah, shut the fuck up. I know what my mom would feel about me. I don't need you telling me this.
But my heart also breaks for the person saying that, because they want to help.
I know.
They want you to feel it. And then, like, what is it doing? It's making the person be like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to create that moment.
Well, then I had this other friend whose dad died, and we were all kind of joking. We're like, welcome to the club, you know, the dead parents club. But his dad died, and he was like, you know, someone was like, I dedicated my yoga practice today to your dad. And he was like, fuck you. Like, my dad would not have wanted your yoga practice. But he eventually said all he wanted people to say was, I love you. Like, I love you. And this coming from a guy who I don't think of as being, like, exceptionally touchy-feely or anything.
Right.
And I guess, you know, there are ways to calibrate I love you, depending what the...
I love you, man.
Yeah.
Love you, bro. Back slap hug?
Yeah.
Just a back slap hug. We don't need to go both arms. Let's not get carried away.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about you as a version of I love you, you know?
Yeah. Like, and I was like a little tipsy on Christmas Eve. Not bad, but I was just like, you know, I'm always like a little like emotional at the holidays anyway, mm-hmm. in the way that most people are, I think. But just like heightened emotions, 2, maybe 3 glasses of wine. And I was like, oh shit. Like, I hadn't reached out. So I wrote this email to this woman who's been widowed. And it was just like, hey, I just want you to know, I've been thinking of you guys every single day since I saw you. And, her name has, like, I'm not going to say her name, but it's one of these names that can be spelled like multiple different ways. I fucking misspelled it. So I sent the email, and then realized when I looked at her email address, I was like, oh my God, I just misspelled my friend's name in an email. And like, then I emailed a second time to be like, hey, I'm sorry. And I was like, am I layer? And then I sent that, and then I was like, oh my God, I just
followed up.
Yes.
Sorry about the misspell.
It's
still
Christmas
thinking
Eve.
About
I
you.
I had an extra glass of wine. I probably shouldn't even be, you know, it's just like the neurotic thing. So I didn't get any response, though.
Yeah.
And I don't expect one. You know, yeah. What are you going to do? Sit there and like respond to every email you get saying like, hey, thinking of you. But I guess I'm just like going back to what my mom always told me. It's like, err on the side of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you piss them off or fuck it up, I think it's better than doing nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know. And I'm a hypocrite because I'm in this situation right now where someone, a friend of mine's parent just died, and I'm not that close to him, but I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. And I'm not close enough to him to say, I love you, you know, but it's like, so I kind of err on the, I'm thinking about you guys.
Yeah.
You
I
know?
Think handwritten notes are good. there's something, I think, I don't know, there's something about getting a letter in the mail that's been written by a human hand.
Yeah.
That is nice. It's like, oh, like somebody took the time. It's better than an email.
Oh, way better.
You know, and I tend to, that tends to be my mode if I'm doing something like that, is I try to write by hand.
Do you have personalized stationery?
No, I have this. It's like right up here. It's just blank,
mm-hmm.
but it's stationery. It doesn't have my name on it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I just wondered if, you know, you were a monogram type.
I'm just blank. It's like blank, cream-colored card.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like after my buddy died, like one of my best friends, like a few years ago, and I would write a letter to his parents every month.
Wow.
Just because I was just like, oh, these poor fucking people,
you yeah. know?
And I guess I hate the idea of somebody just feeling lonely in mm-hmm. that, you know? It's the least I can do. I think they appreciated it too.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Something happened really, a woman I went to graduate school with she would call me her big sister. Like she was younger, very sweet. And we weren't like very close, but we were in workshops together. She died recently in the fall, just a few months ago. And
how'd she die?
She had Crohn's disease, and then it was like a complication in the hospital. And so really sudden. And her dad, I really don't want to cry, but her dad was like, you know, she pre-ordered your book the minute it was available. So like, it'll arrive any day now. And like, that just kind of killed me because that's just the kind of person she was, just so supportive and so excited.
Sympathetic joy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which isn't always, I think the other day I was talking about it. I said empathetic joy is the wrong usage, but like sympathetic joy is something like I am a fan of and like want to have more.
It's like one of my favorite experiences.
Yeah. Like when you're happy for somebody.
So it's the best because like you don't have any of the complicated feelings about the happiness that they surely do. So you just get to be like, yes, it's the best, you know?
Right.
Yeah. A total sympathetic joy person. And it also made me feel like an asshole because she's dead,
right.
You know?
Right.
And I think about her parents. I mean, I guess that's one thing I want to say is like, we've talked about so many dead people in the last however long. And, you know, I experienced like the most sort of natural death in some ways. Like a child witnesses their parents' death a lot,
yeah.
you know, more
yeah,
often
yeah, yeah.
than not.
Sure.
What seems harder for me to imagine in some ways is losing a child.
Oh my God.
Losing
yeah.
a spouse.
Yeah.
Someone told me the other day they had to take her sister off life support. Like all of these things I think are actually like, I said to her, I can't even imagine that. And she said, I think you can. And I was like, well, I don't know. It's different. And I think the loss of probably a spouse or a child is just our best friend, you know, like that hasn't happened to me yet. And
it's different. I don't, you know, it's the same, but different. I think that, you know, losing someone out of time, like you say, in the natural course of
right.
things, like from a nature perspective,
right.
child mourns the loss of parent is a much more natural way of going about it than parent mourns the loss of child. Like
yeah.
that's just, you know, that to me is the one that, that you want to try to avoid.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to even contemplate, but, it happens, you know, and like I was saying earlier, and it's sort of like, for me anyway, it brings some comfort and I feel like it's healthy just to remember how inextricably linked life and death are and how they're happening at the same time. You know, like the skin cells on your body constantly like renewing themselves. You scratch
yeah.
your arm and like thousands of them fall to the ground, like invisibly dead.
Mm-hmm.
So like we're dying right now. We've been dying. Everyone listening has been dying for the past 90 minutes. But it's true. Like, this is the thing, is that it's true. It's scientifically true. It's not just like woo-woo spiritual true.
Right.
But it's something that we forget. And you talk about impermanence. You know, you can't have life without death.
You can't.
You got to have it.
It's just such a heartbreaker, though. Like, it does make me mad.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me mad.
It's hard. But, you know, like where are you in terms of like spiritual stuff in the afterlife? I mean, obviously going through a grief like this, you probably have entertained all sorts of ideas. But were you raised with anything that has stayed with you? Or did you come to any new understanding in the aftermath of your mother's death that has given you some sort of like comfort or steadiness?
No, I don't believe in an afterlife. I just think she's dead, you know, but I think like,
what about reincarnation?
Well, I don't know. I guess what I think is like compelling about reincarnation is, you know, just our energetic principles of things, energy not being created or destroyed and just reforming itself. But I don't know. I don't know about reincarnation. Do you believe in reincarnation?
I tend to, like, just like you say, it's a state change.
Yeah.
Like I'm into what's observably true,
right,
if I'm going to like put a stake in the ground. And so I do think that in some way, whatever, it, like, cause I'm not my mind,
mm-hmm,
and I'm not my body. These things are impermanent. And then there's like, you know, what is this animating life force in me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I just this like meat, you know, of human, physical body? I also think of like the fact that I'm created from my parents and my parents were created from their parents and so on back through,
yeah,
the millennia. So your mother is you, your father is you, like demonstrably.
Right.
So she's still alive right now,
right,
in you. And then, I think too, like of psychedelic experiences, where you sort of like, I don't know, just for a brief moment, I've like touched and I feel like had access to some like oversoul or like, or it touched me. Like, I don't know. Like there's some, I guess the only thing I could say with any kind of, clarity or definitiveness is just that there is much more than meets the eye,
mm-hmm,
in terms of our reality. And so who's to say,
mm-hmm,
but I think that everything's deeply interconnected, and I mean everything and everyone. And, at the very bottom of it all, or the top of it all, the very core of it all, I like to believe that it's very benevolent,
mm-hmm,
and peaceful and, mm-hmm, full of love, you know? And that's like what I think is like at the bottom of all of us, but it's just like lacquered over with all this bullshit.
Yeah. I think those moments of remembering and forgetting, the remembering moments for me on some level are about accessing, or it's not accessing, it's being made aware of some sort of unseen, energetic kind of principle or something. And often it's revealed, I think, through the beauty of the natural world. But I think one of the biggest surprises for me was when I saw my mother's body, and it was like, it just could not have been more not her.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I had never experienced that before. And I was just like, well, this isn't her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agree with you. And I think there's something about like an animating principle, and we see it sometimes. And I think we don't see it much of the time,
but it's always there.
But it's always there. But I don't think it's like God. I think it's more like, I guess I think of it as like aliveness or something, like the,
well, I run into this problem with kids where it's like my daughter who's 8, I mean, going way back, she was like, well, what is there God?
Mm-hmm.
And we sent her to an Episcopal school for a little while. So it's like, it's opening up all kinds of cans of worms, but you know, it's kind of a heavy responsibility. It's like, well, what do I say?
Right.
And what I just took to saying is like, I was like, honey, God is everything.
Yeah.
It's not some like, you know, overhead projector. It's not some like judge in the sky. It's not some paternalistic, you know, critic or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just, it's all of this, all of it, you, me,
mm-hmm,
you know? And so that's like the safest answer I could come up with that also felt like actually in sync with what I tend to believe. Because you either think it's everything or it's nothing.
Right. Right.
You know, and I don't think that like monotheistic, anthropomorphized versions, of God or definitions of God are all that helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately they can be perverted and, can just lead to a lot of psychological dysfunction.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe that's the optimist in me or somebody who wants to have a more hopeful view just as a sustaining principle. It's like, do you really want to just be like, no, I'm an atheist. It's a fucking godless, cold universe. There's nothing to it. I mean, like that to me, that just discounts, like to me it all, it feels like the flip side of a, really dogmatic religious view,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the irony.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want dogma.
Right.
I don't want identity in religion. I don't want to derive my sense of identity. Like I'm a Catholic or I'm a Buddhist or I don't want any of that. I want like a way of life that lends itself towards deeper understanding and like genuine peace and happiness. And if there are like things that I can do, mm-hmm. great. And then I think I want to have an open view of existence and the universe and all that is that has some humility in it. Like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
This is weird.
Exactly.
And that is open to the possibility of, you know, a lot of different things.
I want a sense of wonder.
Yeah.
You know, I always want there to be a sense of wonder and awe and there to be room for that. And it seems like dogma doesn't leave a lot of room for that. I asked my mom, though. I asked her at one point, like, do you believe in God? And she said, people are my church, which, like, is more specific than God's everywhere and God is everything. But she did kind of think the experiences of heaven and hell were earthly experiences.
I like, believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like psychological.
Yeah.
And emotional. You know, that's what I'm saying. Heaven and hell are like, we've been, I'm sure like most people have been through both at different, you know, intervals in life.
And, we don't need an afterlife.
No.
It's like all.
You're going to come back. I think we're going to come back.
What do you want to come back as?
I'm sure I'd come back as a person.
Sure?
No, I'm just saying, like, I guess I'd come back.
Okay.
I mean, maybe I'll come back as, like, an aardvark. I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
But I think, like, if you subscribe to that notion that this thing is circular and that, you know, there are just different turns of the wheel and it's been going on eternally.
Yeah.
Then we've all been just about everything.
Sure.
You know, infinitely back through. I mean, who knows? Back and forth. Or it could be a big simulation.
That's when like I start to get really confused when the simulation talk starts.
But I mean, it's like, I'm open to that possibility,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there's some like extraterrestrial, like higher life force of like, you know, vastly greater intelligence than us. Who's like somehow, who fucking knows?
Who knows?
I mean, it's like, you know, at some point it gets silly and unproductive to start to go too deeply into this stuff just because it's so unknowable.
But the kids thing, I think, is like a really interesting way to think about energy states and how they change. Because I remember being in the delivery room when my niece was born, and I thought she looked like my mother as soon as I looked in her face. And over time, I don't really think that she's like my mom. I actually think that she and I are so alike. I just really relate to her in this deep way. And, but of course I'm of my mother and she's of my mother too. So it's just like all this kind of like, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And that must be kind of the most mind blowing trippy thing about being a parent. And at the same time that they're so totally unique and immediately their own being that has nothing to do with you.
That's true too.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, this is just like a mini me. And then they do something where you're like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah.
You're so weird. Well, it's so great to meet you. And I love your book. Congratulations on, you know, working through all this stuff so beautifully. And are you working on another book? Or it's like, you know, take a time out after this?
I think I want to write. I'm writing a novel, but, you know, whatever. Like,
is it griefy or is it?
No,
okay.
It's not griefy. It's lifey.
Lifey.
But, yeah,
I gotta try that.
You're doing it. You're totally doing it. I loved meeting you.
My podcast is, lifey.
It totally.
The book that I'm working on is griefy, but I just gotta get it out of me.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that feeling?
Yes.
Like, I gotta get this fucking thing done. Then I'll move on. Like, I, you know, but if I don't get this done, I can't really do anything else.
What, I mean, I know, like, we're done, but, like, what,
how much time do you have?
What needs to happen? Like, what's...
I think I just need to find a way to tell it that feels, it sounds so silly, just feels right, and puts down what I want to put down in a way that I can live with that doesn't seem too treacly or self-pitying. You know, it's like finding the right tone, wanting there to be some humor maybe in there instead of just having it just be this heavy sort of like, you know, overbearingly bleak book. I don't want that to be the case. I want it to be like life affirming.
Yeah.
And that's not always easy, especially if you're dealing with heavy emotions. And then I just think that in the composition of the book over the period of time that I've been doing it, there are a lot of different things that happened that sort of like caused it to reconstitute itself and just knocked me off course. So it's sort of like feeling like, okay, can the punches just stop coming so I can take a breath and do this thing? Cause it wasn't just like one thing.
Have you given it to anyone yet?
Yeah. I mean, there's been iterations that I've written the book like multiple times, to completion. And like, I even handed it to my agent at one point and like, we sort of like towed the waters, but people were like, it's not right. It's too heavy. And I was like, yeah, it is. So it's like wanting to get to that point where I feel like a sense of like happiness about it, as opposed to like, here's my sad book.
Right. Right. Cause you're so funny in real life too.
I've had people be like, why don't you just write a funny book? And I'm like, I want to.
Right.
But can I write a funny, griefy book?
Yes, I think is probably the answer. But also, like, isn't this why we get to be writers, is so we can express something in writing that we don't always express in daily life? Like, I'm pretty, you know, light, jokey, whatever.
Yeah.
But it feels nice to be able to dip into something really different. So maybe you needed to write the really depressing thing and now you're just going to like sprinkle some jokes in.
Just got to work in some jokes, like one per chapter or two. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been great to talk about all of this stuff.
Thank you.
And I wish you well on the next thing.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.
All right. There she is, folks. That is Sarah McCall. Her memoir is called Joy Enough. It is available now from Live Right Press. You can find Sarah online at sarahmccall.com. That's McCall with an O, McColl. She's on Twitter. She's on Instagram. Sarah McCall, Joy Enough. Go get your copy now. Thank you to Kel Rockstars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to support this program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. Don't forget, this podcast has its own app. The Other People with Brad Listy app is free. Go get it. It's free. It's a good way to listen. Next week on the program, who do I have? I believe I have Sam Lipsight. I'm not 100% sure on scheduling because I might do a Sunday episode. I might, because I'm dangerous.